track session number 20457, reel 30.
Brigadier Randall, reel 30. You were describing how this driver was approached by two men, yeah, and he challenged them.
Well, Nichols, Private Nichols.
Yes.
Anyway, they approached him in a very hostile way. He gave a correct warning three times, and they came on. So he opened fire, and went, killed the first chap outright, and went through him and seriously wounded the second. This, of course, in a time on a vulgar phrase, the ship barely hit the fan. Mm-hmm. But I carried out my own inquiries, and it was absolutely clear to me that the Nichols had done what he thought. He acted within the terms of engagement. He thought he was under process. He's only a weak little man. One or two big chaps in the battalion would have probably kicked him in the balls and given him the butt stroke and put the bend in the next one. But that wasn't it. But he was a little small man. He couldn't afford, quite absolutely rightly, to let himself be grappled and perhaps lose his weapon and be killed. So he did the right thing. So as far as I'm concerned, he had to be supported, and he was not going to be sacrificed on any altar of expediency. However, there had to be an inquest. The inquests in British Guiana were not conducted in England. They were conducted more like a murder inquiry, and such things as the rule of evidence and leading questions, all that sort of thing. So I was a bit concerned about this. So we engaged the best counsel we could in a guy who was a black chap, but he'd been called to the bar in London. He was a chap who, at his best, could sway any jury, but not at his best. The thing was, I discovered that he had to have just the right amount of rum. If he'd had an insufficient, he was dull and plodding and uninspired. If he had too much, he became absolutely incoherent. So John Wills, the platoon commander, and the company commander, I said, your job is to bring... the army will get to pay for his defence. Your job to find out, and I'm leaving this to you. But I was a bit worried about if things went wrong. So I went to see the garrison commander, who unfortunately was an infantry officer, and I said, look, no way am I going to have this chap sacrificed if it goes against him. And he said, you're dead right. So we hatched a plan. I was going to put him, if he's gone again, I was going to put him on the first plane out at regimental expense, and making quite clear to the governor and the commissioner of police and everybody else that I wasn't putting him outside the law. I was perfectly prepared for him to be produced for any court of law, court of inquiry, under British military law or under the law of England. I then also did something which I haven't actually generally known, but I was very concerned as to where the jury for this inquest would be held, because if it was impaneled in the area where the thing came, it was solid communist. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't listen to the evidence. So I tried to find out who was responsible. I just found out that it was a black district superintendent of police called Randy something. And I rang him up and said, look, Randy, about this business. I said, I'm not trying to nobble the jury. All I want you to do is to tell me where you're going to impanel it. All I want is to impanel it to people who will judge the case on the evidence and not on prejudice. So he said, I get the message. Anyway, he did. He held it some distance away and the chap got off. But it was, it would have been quite a... funnily enough, years later, the governor was a chap called Sir Richard Late, a distinguished... he became a personal friend. I was staying with him in Cape Town years later, and we were talking about this. I said, well, what would you have done? We were on Christian M. What would you have done, Dick? And I then... He said, quite honestly, he said, you know, as a soldier, he'd been a soldier, got a DSM, the South African Army. He said, I don't know, he said... As a soldier, I would have welcomed it. As the governor, I think I'd have been bloody cross. But funny enough, some weeks later, I had a phone call out of the blue. This Randy rang me up and said, "Look, Colonel," he said, "you remember, I gave you a bit of help." And I said, "Indeed, Randy." He said, "Well, I need a bit of help now." I said, "Well, if I can help you, I will." Anyway, he had been interrogating some chap. And he was, stupidly. It wasn't brutality. To get him to talk, he put a smoke grenade between the chap standing here, he put it between his legs. So it didn't do it. The idea was just to envelop him in smoke. But unfortunately, the fumes near his body, this chap's balls all got in a hell of a bloody state. And so there was a hell of a row about it. And so Randy said, "Have you got anybody?" He said, "I really didn't know that a smoke grenade could do that." I said, "Well, nor did I." He said, "Have you got any weapon expert who can say that it was unreasonable for this to happen?" So anyway, I did my best for him and got some chap who'd done a small arms course to read the pamphlet out. Oh, that's a digression.
What happened to this obliging policeman then? Did he get off, do you know?
I think it... Well, a matter of fact, his boss, Commissioner of Police, Peter Owen, who became a friend of mine, who I stayed with subsequently out in the Cayman Islands, he stood by his chap, and they sacked Peter Owen.
Oh, did they?
Mm. And he went on to be Commissioner of Police in Aden, which was an even tougher assignment. He seemed to catch all the tough ones. Mm. But years later, I say he was a personal friend. We used to go to Lord's. I was staying with him in the Cayman Islands. He told me all about this. I mean, he knew that I had had a word with his DSP. But I said, "Well, Peter, it wouldn't have been fair for me to go to you, because it would put you in an invidious position." He said, "You're quite right, but you played it, as far as I'm concerned, you played it absolutely right." But well, it was, again, I had the problem that, because I had these three quite widely separated areas. Mm-hmm. Companies I was talking about earlier on, that if you just let, some of the two locations were terrible, just in one building. Yeah. Other ones were in very comfortable places on a sugar estate with a swimming pool, so I had to keep on
rotating them
round. And my boss, who I got on with jolly well, he said, "You know, I don't agree with this. Your chap should get there and know the area." And I said, "Well, it's not that situation. It's not IS." Well, I said, "The thing I've got to combat against is boredom and low morale. If my chaps know that, well, however bloody awful it may hear, they're going to be somewhere else next week. It's something you look forward to. They're only here for a fortnight. A change. Anyway, we had a bit of argument, but he said, "Yeah," he said, "Well, you must command your battalion as you think fit." But I said, "Well, those are my reasons, and I would take it. I would be very upset if you were interfered in what I think is my prerogative." But I mean.
What happened? You said there were two chaps who attacked Private Nichols, and the first one was killed, and the second one was wounded.
He recovered.
Do you know what happened to him?
Well, he was produced at the inquest and gave evidence.
And what was he? Was he tried for?
I don't think so. I think they reckoned that they didn't want to stir the pot too much. He'd been badly wounded and hospitalised, and that was good enough, actually. Well, there was no doubt about it. They were having a go. It wasn't. They weren't coming up to ask the time or when's the next bus to Piccadilly Circus. So my chap did that.
He did the right thing.
And of course, he was the funny little, tiny, insignificant sort of chap. He was always known as Killer Nichols afterwards. You know. Here comes the old killer. You remember that chap H. Jones who won the Victoria Cross?
At Goose Green?
At Goose Green. He was one of my platoon commanders.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he was a Devon Dorsey.
Yes. What impression did you get of him at that time?
Oh, he was a good chap. Mm. He was always arguing.
Always arguing?
Well, he liked that sort of thing. Not always arguing, no, but I remember... There was at that time, Northern Ireland, they had a thing called support platoon.
Yes.
Which was a sort of bastard thing. So each platoon had one mortar section and one anti-tank section, which is fine operationally, but for training purposes it was ludicrous. So I said, well, I'm going to polish this. I'm going to put all the mortar sections in one platoon, and that's the mortar platoon, and all the anti-tank in another. And the two platoon commanders didn't like this, so they formed up, and H. Jones was one of them. He was the mortar officer. Right, okay. I said, well, I've listened to, so they, and we had a big argument, actually, but and he took it very loyally in the end. But he was a chap who liked to push his own views. I liked him a lot, actually. Some people find him a bit difficult. When he turned up to my predecessor, there was this old Italian who turned up, and he used to wear a monocle, and he marched in and then sort of put his monocle up and sort of slightly stared at the sea. My preacher, who said, Jones, take that bloody eyeglass out and don't let me ever see you wear it again. He was a good platoon. I was carried. Most of my platoon commanders finished up as general. So I said, I'm not going around boasting, it's because they were trained by me. I had an armchair ride with all these talented young subalterns. And of course, it was a pretty good honour for platoon commanders. It was wonderful. They had their own little platoon area to look, everything to look after. Trail programme, they had to minister them. It was a sort of platoon commander's paradise. And they were all jolly, they all rose to the challenge. They all loved it. I had to lay down the operational policy, but the execution was done at company and platoon commander level.
How did you actually devise that policy? Did you get that as a result of instructions from the governor?
Well, you see, once civil, about the time he went out there, civil order broke down.
Yes.
So the governor assumed direct powers. And twice, or at the worst, three times a week, we met at Government House. There was the governor, deputy governor, commissioner of police, the British garrison commander, and the two commanding officers. And that's where we hammered it out. And this, the governor always listened to what I and Bill MacDonald of the Queensland Buff said, what we thought of. And of course, I'm not a chap sitting in the office, so I spent most of my time, I had virtually my own helicopter, because the helicopter section was commanded by a chap who'd been in the Devons with me in Keeley. So he said, don't worry about bidding, I want a helicopter. So I could get anywhere and I'd have light aircraft. So I spent most of my time going around this vast area, feeling the temperature at sort of at the coal face. And so I was able to come back and I think make a contribution. But I always talk to my company boy. I'd go and talk to the district superintendent of police, but careful not to say anything which would offend the commissioner of police. But who, in any case, we were, at that time we were friends. But so we were able to bring some influence to bear on the decisions. And for instance, the Home Guard idea was one that I pushed, and that found favour. Obviously, that was only the military side, but there were a lot of other sort of background of union and things which were no concern of mine. But so I was actually sitting for that. All the policy decisions were taken there and then. So it's fascinating.
Apart from the murdering and looting and arson that had been done by the Forbes Burnham's chaps.
Yes, some of the communist Indians too.
They did the same thing.
Yes.
Were there actual riots and other large-scale disorders?
Oh, no. I mean, the people there were extraordinarily friendly. I mean, the British soldiers really had a whale of a time. You see, the other battalion handled Georgetown. At one time, I could have handled Georgetown, but I was given the option. I said, I didn't want my battalion stuck in Georgetown, because Georgetown, quite a big place. It was full of umhouses and knocking shops, and I think one would have had a hell of a problem keeping soldiers in order there. So I volunteered for the wide open spaces, which I knew my company commanders would like. And the buffs, they did Georgetown, and just a little bit outside Georgetown. So that's the way it worked. So my soldiers would just come through when they were, I'd swap companies around, they'd come in, they'd have a 48 hours, when they'd go and sort of thrash it up
in Georgetown.
Georgetown, and then they'd go out. I did have company headquarters, battalion headquarters. But there was a hell of a risk of VD. I mean, the girls there are absolutely gorgeous. They're a mixture of sort of black and Indian and Chinese. I got into trouble with the padre because I said that every soldier booking out would book out with a French letter. And he ran me into the garrison commander and said I was encouraging fornication. And I said, well, Colonel, you can't have it both ways. You keep on saying you want to keep VD down. Well, I do something practical to stop it. You're now complaining. And I said, look at my VD figures. They're much lower than the buffs. Because I said that if a chap goes out and meets some gorgeous girl, he had a few rums, he's not going to remember a parson's sermon if he heard it, but he might just remember he's got a French letter in his pocket. And Colonel said, well, okay, John. So I was lucky there. I didn't really have too much trouble with my soldiers. And we had no military police there, which was a good thing.
Why?
Well, because there's two COs, so we don't want them.
Why is it a good thing?
Well, because I have my own provost sergeant.
Yes.
And you know what's interesting. This was trouble there. A sergeant would know how to... He'd know the chaps. He'd know whether he's a chap, you belt him over, knock him out, or whether you say, come on, soldier, back to barracks. And it doesn't... Their own cap badge, their own... people. But as soon as the average soldier sees a red cap, you know, it's just like a red rag to a bull. And so Bill MacDonald and I said, no, we don't want it. We don't want a section of red caps here. We can handle it. And the garrison commander, faced by two COs, quite adamant about it. And it worked.
Apart from the VD and the rum, what other hazards were there to health in Guyana? What could you do about them?
Well, I only had two court martials. One was a sentry sleeping. Felt sorry for him, really. He just could not keep awake. But I thought I had to make an example because, I mean, well, let me tell you, I mean, a chaplain sleeps put himself and all his comrades
at risk.
At risk. Yeah. And I had to make an example. I felt sorry for this chaplain. He was desperately, you know, I remember writing to his mother and saying, you know, I'm sorry to tell you. I remember Ken Darling, well, this time Ken Darling had given up one British corps. He was Commander-in-Chief of Southern Command. He came out. And, of course, he was glad, having been his DAMS. And he said, any problems? And I said, well, I've just had a court-martial chat for that. He said, you're dead right. He said, you simply cannot have that. Mm-hmm. And the other case was where a chap simply put his Sten gun, or what it was, not Sten,
Sterling
down to do something quite proper on duty, and the next moment it had gone.
Been taken.
Then an officer did the same.
Lost a weapon.
Under the same circumstances. It was a bit difficult. It was actually Wilsey. One or two people got her when people said, well, I hope I'm not going to sort of John Wills a promising officer. I said, I couldn't have nothing to do with it. I said, I can't have one rule for officers in a matter like this and one rule for soldiers. So I'm not going to have it. I said, I'm not going to court martial him. I'm going to run him in on a formal charge. The garrison commander, the full colonel, couldn't deal with him, but I had to run him in and get him a reprimand. But you can't, I don't think you can have one, not something like that, a clear-cut thing like that.
Absolutely not. No.
You can't. And John was years later, he said, you know, I've done exactly the same as you. You had no option. You were quite right to put me on it.
But I mean, I'm talking about hazards to health, like disease and so forth. Yes, because Guyana has a reputation for being a rather dangerous place.
Yes. Strange enough, we didn't really. We'd had the all the inoculation, get yellow fever and that sort of thing. There was a risk of a thing something like elephantiasis. Mm. But we did get very, very good food there.
Yes.
Imported from America. The rations were absolutely the best I've ever had anywhere. Very good food. There was we didn't really. You have the vampire bats there. They're not quite huge; they're quite tiny, and they would nibble and say. I remember some gunner saying, "God, I've been bitten by a vampire," and all his mates were saying, "Well, bad luck, you know. Here comes Frankenstein or Dracula, you know, Dracula." and they could give you some unpleasant thing, but. No, we had very. I don't think. We didn't have anybody home. It was quite remarkable how healthy we were. We had mosquito nets and things. Health wasn't a hazard there. They had a very good doctor, Irish doctor, who was pretty good. I mean, he could sense a scrimshanker from a genuine sick. Scrimshanker got rough treatment if he was genuinely sick. He was a compassionate man. No, we didn't, really. Surprising. We played a funny sort of situation because you weren't really in any risk from the local. So we played a lot of rugger, not cricket. They were too good for the cricket. Yeah. We got on very well with the Queensland bus, extraordinarily well. Only because the two, Sierra, he'd been dormant or been in the Indian Army. And way on, we said, well, we more or less agreed that there's two ways you can play this. You can either beat each other straight, trying to share everybody up, or you can... They were very good to us when we first went out, and then two of their sergeants went AWOL.
What happened to them?
Well, we picked them up. And so you're supposed to report all those sort of incidents in the sort of SITREP, and I told my IO, I said, this is not going in the SITREP, I don't want the garrison commander or the governor or anybody else. But there's no way will it go in. And I just told our company commander just to send them back. And the bus were grateful for that sort of. So we got on. The only rivalry was on the sports field. We went out of our way to help each other and so on. And it was a very happy situation.
What have these two sergeants been doing? Why have they gone AWOL?
No, they were heading off towards Venezuela. I think there were some women in it. There were quite a lot of my soldiers who were happily married in England had sort of liaisons. I mean, the girls there were, someone in my officers did too. what they did discreetly. There were plenty of white girls around too, but there were the women there were very, very attractive, they weren't too resident, and so a lot of my soldiers. Then I had problems with the Daily Mirror, but one soldier wanted to marry a girl, and she wasn't. And so I said I wasn't going to agree to it, and I'd send him home, and so he then wrote home, and his mother wrote to the Daily Mirror. Mm. And this question came sort of flashing out. I was to explain why I was adopting racialist business. And we sorted it out.
How was that resolved? Because that's a rather delicate issue, isn't it?
She was a bit of a hooker. So I said to the RSM, look, just get me three or four statements. So he got three or four statements from soldiers that they'd all had her for five bob. Round behind the banyan tree, and I said this back to the minister. I said, look, I'm not back the way. If she'd been a respectable girl, but soldiers are out here under temptation. Here's a chap who's infatuated with a common prostitute, and here are the evidence of three soldiers who had her for the same price. That's the end of it. It was true, true. I mean, I hadn't fixed it. My dad would have fixed it. But I didn't have to.
And what did you hear any more from the Daily Mirror, or was there, that went quiet?
Went quiet. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you do. You know, chaps get out. You do have some, you know, chap could ruin his life marrying a girl like that. I mean, I think that chaps marrying respectable. Black, brown, yellow, anybody else. I mean, I'm not racist, but he was just a long way from home, the hot sun, he was a bit red, and he just thought it was the real thing, I reckon. He did actually, long afterwards, he came up to me, he said, you know, sir, he said, I'm very grateful to you, I gave you a hard time, he said, I'm grateful for what you did. So, but it could have been tricky.
Did you have any other encounters with the press?
Well, the press came out from time to time. No, I mean, I didn't give them any cause to, really. It was a bit of a backwater in a way, because, I mean, I see Borneo was on, as I said earlier, and Aden was on. The British Army was probably as a stretch as it's ever been. Mm. They wouldn't have sent me out a weak battalion if they hadn't been. And British Guiana was pretty well the ends of the earth, really. So that we didn't really, apart from the day we flew out, which was headlines at the time, they've still got the cutting. It just lapsed back into a little military backwater.
What was the situation then when you left? Had it all calmed down and gone?
Well, then we had the satisfaction of about a month before, you know, of general elections.
Yes. Did you have to do anything to...
Well, we had to be very careful.
Those.
We discussed this with the governor of Westwood. What we had to try and do in the lead-up, we had to make sure that all the canvassing and all the preliminaries were done without violence. Mm. At the same time, we didn't want our political players to say, well, this is an election under the shadow of British bayonets. Mm. So, and we also had to prevent clashes between the rival parties, and so my company commander, two commanders, had quite a busy time, because they said, well, you can have anybody can have a meeting, but they've got to be done on a programme, so they don't clash. So that was one thing. And then every meeting had to have a military police presence in the background, not worrying about what was said there, but to prevent any antis coming along and breaking it up. That kept the soldiers very, very busy.
What about the actual polling stations? Did you have to guard those when voting?
Well, then on the day, my battalion was spread out over something like 300 miles. Mm. The polling stations, they had to be, I think that was mostly left to the police. Mm. But there had to be a police presence there to see that it was orderly. But at the same time, Not a policeman sort of standing there looking down what the chap.
No.
So it had to be done with some discretion. Then I had to have sort of soldiers available to go if there was any trouble. In fact, there wasn't any trouble anywhere. I spent the whole day, I got up at the crack of dawn and spent the whole day flying in a helicopter from one end of British Guiana to the other, just calling in at every platoon and place. But it all went off very well, actually. And so actually, in the end, at the end of the 8 months, we had a certain amount of job satisfaction, because we had gone out when it was in chaos and anarchy, and we'd seen it through we'd completed the task we were given. I mean, it wasn't any great military through, but we'd done what Her Majesty's government was to help the country go to independence, so I find personally quite fulfilling. Well,
did you have any casualties?
No, not one. Nobody got killed, and nobody married anybody undesirable. In fact, nobody married anybody. They didn't need to.
Wasn't a requirement.
No, it was quite tough. I even got an OBE for it. Which was unusual in those days. They didn't give OBEs to COs in those days.
What happened to you when you got back from Guiana? Was it back to Northern Ireland, or?
We went back to Northern Ireland, but then after about a month, I handed over. Oh.